Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, countdown to Copenhagen. As world leaders gather for the crucial climate change conference, we hear more about the moral issues at the heart of the debate. And stay tuned for episode 20 of our weekly radio drama, The Vatican Centuries, looking at the places and people who make up the history of the Vatican. Government leaders, politicians, religious representatives and non-governmental organisations from around the world are converging on the city of Copenhagen this weekend ahead of the crucial climate change conference due to begin on Monday and run through until December the 18th. The challenge facing those world leaders is to secure an international agreement on stopping global warming exceeding the danger threshold of 2 degrees Celsius by dramatically cutting the amount of carbon dioxide emissions, widely believed to be responsible for rising temperatures with disastrous consequences for the poorest nations in particular. Church leaders in many countries have been doing lots of awareness raising in the lead up to this conference about the moral and ethical issues regarding the future of our planet. In Britain, all the main churches and faith groups have been taking part in a huge demonstration organised by a coalition called Stop Climate Chaos. Entitled The Wave, the demonstration in the heart of London on Saturday was billed as the biggest ever climate justice rally, with hundreds of thousands of campaigners dressed in blue or carrying blue banners, making a human wave to remind politicians of their responsibilities in Copenhagen. Ahead of the main rally, Christians from across the country took part in an ecumenical prayer service in Westminster Central Hall, led by Archbishop Vincent Nicholls, head of the Catholic Bishops' Conference in England and Wales, and Anglican Archbishop of Canterbury, Dr. Rowan Williams. During his recent visit to Rome, I asked Dr. Williams about his concerns over climate change and his message to world leaders gathering in the Danish capital.
I think the main message is twofold. First of all, there is no possibility of pretending that this is anything other than urgent. This is a major issue confronting us now. Whatever the detail of the science of climate change, the facts of climate change and the facts of environmental degradation are there to be seen. And I was speaking a couple of weeks ago to a political leader, from the Pacific region, who spoke of how he and his government were preparing a DVD to be shown at Copenhagen, which illustrated the immediate effect. So that's the first thing. It's urgent, it's visible, it's immediate. The second thing is, care for the environment is a good thing to be involved in, whether or not we avert the disasters of climate change. It is a better life to live in harmony with God's creation than otherwise. And so we have to do this because it's right, because it's a life-giving, life-enhancing way of approaching our environment and indeed serving God. So, yes, it's urgent. Yes, it's right. Put those together and the conclusion is rather obvious. Do something.
You took your own no-fly pledge, didn't you? You've been very much trying to put this into practice in a very personal way. Would you like to see other faith leaders being more outspoken, leading on this again?
I'd very much hope to see more and more faith leaders coming on board with this. A couple of weeks ago at Lambeth Palace, we had a meeting of faith leaders with the Secretary of State, and a joint statement was produced representing all the 9 major faith traditions in the United Kingdom. So there is already a lot of movement there.
Archbishop Rowan Williams there, who will also be leading an ecumenical service in Copenhagen Cathedral on Sunday the 13th, with the Danish royal family and many of the religious and political leaders attending the 2-week summit. The Holy See is also sending its own delegation to the Copenhagen Conference, led by the permanent observer to the United Nations in New York, Archbishop Celestino Migliore. Meanwhile, Pope Benedict's message for the 2010 World Peace Day on January the 1st is expected to be released over the coming days, focusing on the moral issues at the heart of the environmental debate. Monsignor James Reinhardt is an official at the Pontifical Justice and Peace Council, which advises the Pope on these environmental concerns. He says the Copenhagen conference is more likely to mark the beginning of a process towards agreement on climate change, and he says it's important not to set goals that are too high or impossible to achieve.
Well, from what I have heard, that we are going to be going forward, that they're not going to have an agreement, a binding agreement. My hopes for the final outcome, whatever it is, whether it's in Mexico next year or if they can find a way in between now and then to come to an agreement, that first of all, that the goals aren't set too high. And what I mean is that there's a possibility that we can see that we have to take this giant step, and then someone will realize that that giant step is impossible to meet and then just give up on the goals. We have to set some realistic goals and targets so that they can be realistically dealt with and realistically met.
What do you see in terms of realistic targets?
I think that maybe, possibly, the best that we can do, that the scientists can do, the practitioners, can reshoot for the targets that were set at Kyoto. They haven't been met. Let's meet those first. Kyoto expires. That's why we're having this meeting now. Take a few steps beyond that, a few percentages beyond that. I think that I heard somewhere just in the last couple of days that someone is shooting for a 29% reduction by 2050, maybe. Again, I'm not a scientist. I think that that's unrealistic. When 2030 rolls around and we find ourselves in more dire straits and they realize that they can't or that they won't meet this target, I think that people will just raise up their hands and say, well, we tried, and any momentum will be lost.
How optimistic are you then in this sense? Because there are those who are warning that if Copenhagen or this particular process fails, we're looking at some very bleak prospects for the future of the planet.
I guess it depends on who you speak to. We here at the Council for Justice and Peace, we're still looking at this. I think that that's why the Holy Father chose to make a general statement here in this paper. You know, whether or not all of the numbers are truly in on climate change, whether or not everyone realizes what it's man-made, man-affected, man-impacted, but what part of that, what activity of man is more impactful than others? I think that those are the kind of things that have to be also looked at. And at the same time, then, more and more countries have to be brought on board. That's the failure of Kyoto, that some weren't asked to participate in this as others were. Some refused. And I think that that's probably one of the difficulties that they're finding here at Copenhagen, is that there's a refusal. There's not enough political will spread thick enough or around enough to bring this about.
Thanks there to Monsignor James Reinhardt, an official at the Pontifical Justice and Peace Council. Meanwhile, well-known Irish author and missionary Father Sean McDonough will also be in Copenhagen, following closely the workings of the summit as part of the Franciscans' international delegation. He told me what he sees as the issues at stake at this conference and why he believes the Catholic Church should be in the forefront of the campaign to curb global warming.
I take my standard here from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. These are the scientists who have been looking at climate change since 1988. There are about 3,000 of them, and they cover a whole array of sciences, from physics to meteorology to all kinds of different. So they're looking at climate changing around the world right now. They have asked, as a scientific necessity, that rich countries, like what they call Annex 1 countries, like the United States, most of Europe, that we reduce our greenhouse gas emissions by between 25 and 40% by the year 2020. And that's really essential if we're going to keep the mean global temperature below 2 degrees Celsius. If we don't, it could go spiking. So that's what's on the table. So let's have a look at where the players are at. Well, first of all, from the United States of America, thanks be to God, we have President Obama. He is committed to climate change. His own people in the Treasury are actually committed to it. But the United States process works quite differently. You have to bring in climate change legislation into the House of Representatives and also into the Senate. So you need to have almost 60 senators on your side to get through. And it's slow. So I don't think he'll be able to come with a commitment from the American delegation to these specific numbers. I think they'll try to say, we'd like to see us reaching there. Because he knows, you know, the reality of the fault lines of the United States at the moment. One of them is around healthcare. He fears, and rightly so, because the U.S. Chamber of Commerce has come out recently very strongly against climate legislation, although some companies have actually pulled away from that and say, no, we better get real. But he knows there could be a fault here and it could be political, Democrat and Republican. So he'll be trying to be as competitive as possible, but also trying to make sure, because he knows it's going to affect the United States like everywhere else.
The European governments have been a little more optimistic, perhaps, many of them trying to commit to these goals.
They have. The European government, we have a couple of things out of the way. Elections. Last year, polls announced the election in Germany. This year was one of the major bugbears on the screen. Because in countries like Germany, you have steel making, you have car making, and you have mining. And like they are big users and they're big polluters of CO2. So the Chancellor Angela Merkel was much less committed in Poznan than she was, for example, in Bali the previous year. And then, of course, Poland is now one of the major countries of the European Union, and 80-90% of its energy comes from coal. So those are issues. But it would appear that the European Union will be willing to do the 25-40%, which is... Now, I just like to tell people, this will change the way we live. I may not be sitting here in 2022 if this actually goes through, because it's going to change the way we use energy, the way we travel, the way we embody energy into all the resources we have around us. People should be under no illusion. Don't forget, with Kyoto, they were only asking for 5-7% back in 1997. This is big business. Now, you can help somewhat by the new technologies, but you're going to also have to see a lot of cutback. Then looking across the board at the newly emergent economies. Well, for example, China is now the gross number one polluter. Is up to 26%, but of course per capita, it's only one-fifth of per capita in the United States and less in Europe. They are beginning to say, we're willing to jump with you, but they say to you, look, the Industrial Revolution started at the end of the 18th century. Your prosperity for the last 200 years has been based on fossil fuel, first coal, then oil, then natural gas. So you've got all this prosperity behind you. You shouldn't be asking us to jump as fast as you're jumping, because we've only started on this game. And by the way, okay, you point at the 400 million people who are now middle class, and you probably see some of them wandering around here Rome as tourists. But what about the 600 million people who are still living in major poverty? They say, we need to have some kind of growth that actually will take them out of poverty. But they are also well aware that they are extremely vulnerable, and becoming more well aware, because the number one vulnerability in climate change after severe weather, which we've seen in the Philippines, is glacier melt. And the biggest glaciers, apart from Greenland and Antarctica, are on the Himalayas. All the rivers of Asia come out of that, including Yangtze. So if it melts by 80% by 2030, China is in real problem. The Yangtze provides water for 300 million people. The Yellow River provides much the same, and it comes off the Tibet Plateau. So they're aware and they want to do things. But there will be delicate negotiations right there between the historic people who are like us in Western Europe, whose prosperity was built based on this, and they who are saying, OK, they are putting huge money into alternatives, I must say, wind and even photovoltaic. So I'd have more hope now with China and the United States, particularly with the Obama administration on, that there would be some agreement. I'm hoping they don't pare it back to 20%. That's all I'm basically saying.
Because if we do pare it back even to 20%, which is quite close to the targets we're looking at.
If we do, then we may not reach the goal, which is to keep the average global temperature below a 2 degrees Celsius rise. You see, one of the things the science is doing is the science is telling us, actually, it's more serious, almost certainly by the 6 months and years. If I was here a year ago, for example, which I probably was, at that stage we were saying we could have of carbon dioxide in the air or its equivalent, we could have 440 parts per million, and it wouldn't make that huge difference. Now they're saying that isn't true. We actually need to pare it back to 350. Now we're already at 390. So you can understand the kind of difficulties that we'll have for people, and particularly for people in third world countries.
So you're saying there's much greater scientific precision over these issues
there
now.
Is, absolutely.
There's much greater awareness, you're saying, also
yes.
on the parts of
yeah.
governments,
yeah.
but perhaps not the necessary political conviction to push this agreement through. What are you actually looking for to come out of the conference?
Oh, I'm looking for these countries, what they call Annex 1, the rich countries, do sign up to 25%. And I think that's one place where the churches and people who are in moral positions could be very helpful, because it's going to be difficult. I think the churches, this is a real issue about the well-being of human beings into the future. I mean, it's not one of these issues that, well, we can put it on the long finger. If you wanted to use theological language, it's Kairos moment, which is a crisis. And what I would like to see is the Catholic Church, the leadership of the Catholic Church, being quite specific in this area. Like, there is 3 or 4 paragraphs on ecology in general in the recent papal encyclical by His Holiness Pope Benedict. But I would have loved to have seen a much more clear engagement, like he does on the economy or on labour, with the issues of climate change, and particularly taking on board. I think we can take on board the reality of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. By the way, as I say, it's 3,000 people, and they actually work on lowest common denominators. And on some areas, for example, they won't publish data on it because there's not, for example, a consensus. Like, for example, whether the North Atlantic, the stream, the Gulf Stream that keeps Europe warm, will actually be diluted with the fresh water coming off Greenland and off the Russian River. So they don't come to conclusions on that. So they're very conservative. I would like to see us coming behind that with the moral power to say, look, this is going to be very challenging, but it is for the well-being of you, the poor particularly today, and all humans to come, and also the well-being of the earth. And to put it in those religious languages, to have the precision of the science behind us, that we're not just saying be good and look after the environment and don't throw away. No, we're saying we have looked at this issue, and we think, in the same way as in number 63, for example, of Caritas in Veritate, the Pope can say, I think the International Labour Organization's regulations in terms of migrant workers should be promoted. In other words, the Church is throwing its backing morally behind that kind of position. I'd love to see the same on climate change. And I think if a group like the Roman Catholic Church came out in favour of that, and in its presentation was seen to be very competent, and was seen to be really concerned about the well-being of humans and also about the urgency of it, I think that would have a huge impact. First of all, in terms of preaching the gospel of life, people say, here's a church that actually is willing to put his neck on the line. And also, because as a priest who's into this area, I find young people respond to religion if you present it to them in terms of their concerns like climate change. And like if people went in, I'm going with the Franciscans International, I'm a missionary, my basic concerns will be the adaptation fund, because we're missionaries and we see what's happening. I've had been on to Manila there for the last week about what has happened to the poor of Manila, because we have a parish there. So we're very aware of that. Other groups are on to mitigation and the Greenpeace and all of those. But we want to get, and that would be an important role also for the church on that particular adaptation, that the church would be very, very clear. And it can be, because the Church, the Catholic Church, is a global organisation, and yet it's a local organisation. You have parishes, you have dioceses in Africa, you have parishes, dioceses in Rome and Ireland. And that coming together with knowledge, with commitment and competence, I think would be very, very powerful.
My thanks to Irish author and missionary Father Sean McDonough. And now we present the next part of our weekly radio drama, The Vatican Centuries, written by Jill Bevilacqua and produced by Sean Patrick Lovett. Episode 20 is entitled Splendour and Decline.
The 13th century has been called the greatest of all the centuries, an age of rational and coherent advance in every sphere of life and thought.
Certainly, it was the richest cultural moment for the Europe of the Middle Ages.
It saw the growth of Gothic architecture, the poetry of Dante, the painting of Giotto.
Enthusiasm for learning was at its height, and the universities, led by Paris and Bologna, replaced the monasteries as centres of intellectual effort and attainment. They offered new ideas in law and theology and a sound training in the liberal arts.
Philosophy emerged as a separate area of study. By the end of the century, canon law was also fixed in a scientific system, while almost every possible variety of religious organization had been established.
It was the age of wandering scholars who mingled with the mendicant friars on the crowded roads of Europe. It was the century which saw the fall of Byzantium and the weakening of the empire in the west, while to the east went Marco Polo and the last quarreling crusaders.
The coronation of the Pope in the Middle Ages was followed always by a triumphant cavalcade through the streets to the Lateran Palace. Immediately after his consecration in St. Peter's, the new Pope took his place on a throne at the top of the steps. The archdeacon removed the bishop's mitre from the Pope's head, replaced it with the papal tiara, and amid the joyous acclamation of the people, pronounced these words.
Take the tiara! And know that you are the father of princes and kings, ruler of the world, vicar on earth of our Saviour, Jesus Christ, to whom honour and glory for eternity.
The Pope then mounted a white palfrey draped in scarlet, and the procession set off. First came cross-bearers, standard-bearers with red banners, horsemen carrying lances adorned with golden cherubim, the papal archivist and lawyers in long black robes, the choir schools, the bishops and cardinals, and the Pope himself. The civil authorities and the militia followed, while bringing up the rear were knights in shining armour and the nobility resplendent in their family colours and displaying their coats of arms.
The whole of Rome was strung with garlands, and as the Pope passed under the triumphal arches erected along the papal way, he distributed largesse to the cheering crowds, while the bells pealed out over the city.
At the Lateran, the Pope was greeted with solemn chants and received the homage of the cathedral chapter. The prior gave him the crozier and keys of the church and palace, the former symbolizing his power to govern, the latter his power to loose and bind. The Pope was then draped with a purple silk sash, whose pocket held a handful of musk and 12 seals of precious stones, which symbolized apostolic power and Christian virtues.
The palace staff then came to kiss the Pope's foot, after which he tossed silver to the people, saying, "He distributed it and gave it to the poor. May his justice last forever." After praying a while before the relics in the Sancta Sanctorum, the Pope received the homage of the cardinals and prelates, each of whom held open his mitre, into which the Pope put the traditional offering of money, or presbyterium.
The Roman Senate swore the oath of fealty, and the day ended with a banquet, the Pope sitting alone, while prelates, nobility, senators and judges took their seats at other tables. The most important guests served the Pope with the first courses and then joined the rest of the company.
It was the English contemporary chronicler, Friar Thomas of Eccleston, who made the sad comment, "There is no one who dies as solitary and forsaken as a Pope." But a French bishop, Jacques de Vitry, who arrived in Italy in 1216 to take possession of his diocese, gives us a graphic picture of the sequel to a Pope's death.
In the June of that year, Innocent III was on his way north to Tuscany. He hoped to reconcile the powerful maritime states of Pisa and Genoa so that they would send crusaders to the east. But death overtook him in Perugia, where the Roman Curia were in residence, on the very morning of De Vitry's arrival. On the following day, the Pope's body was borne in an open coffin to the city's cathedral. De Vitry comments,
"That was the day when I really understood the nothingness of earthly grandeur. Incredibly, the preceding night, thieves had entered and stripped the Pope of everything of value he had on. With my own eyes, I saw his half-naked body lying in the middle of the church."
And of the Curia, the bishop had nothing good to say.
"The members are so taken up by temporal affairs and by lawsuits and so preoccupied by everything having to do with kings and states that one can scarcely touch upon questions pertaining to religion. All this caused me much grief.
The last pope of the century was Boniface VIII, another lawyer pope. Boniface was something of a patron of learning, encouraging several universities and founding the University of Rome.
But at the turn of the century, Boniface announced a most extraordinary event. From the loggia of St. John Lateran, he proclaimed the year 1300 to be a jubilee year, the first holy year in history. Special indulgences were attached to visiting Rome and making the rounds of the churches and the shrines. Pilgrims flocked to the city, and the money poured in. Near the altar of St. Paul's outside the walls stood two clerics with rakes pulling the coins in. Although some have given the Pope credit for spiritual motives in proclaiming the Holy Year, it's generally accepted that he needed money, and what more legitimate way of procuring it?
Among the pilgrims who stood under the loggia of St. John Lateran while the Pope gave his benediction were the painter Giotto, and some say the poet Dante. The latter was no lover of Boniface, and portrayed him in hell. Giotto limited himself to recording the Jubilee in a fresco in the loggia, of which the central fragment can still be seen in today's basilica.
Another of the pilgrims was a Florentine merchant, Giovanni Villani, who kept a chronicle. He has left us a delightful account of the Jubilee.
In the year of Christ 1300, the Pope of the time, Pope Boniface VIII, Apostolic, did in the above-mentioned year, in reverence for the birth of Christ, make a sovereign and great indulgence. And this was the manner of it, that any Roman who should visit during that year, for 30 consecutive days, the churches of the blessed apostles Peter and Paul, and for 15 consecutive days all the other people who were not Romans, to all he granted full and entire pardon of all their sins, once they had confessed them, and remitted all fault and punishment. And for the consolation of the Christian pilgrims, every Friday or solemn feast day, the holy veil of Veronica would be shown in St. Peter's. And for this reason, a great number of Christians living at that time made this pilgrimage, men and women both, from various countries near and far. And it was the most wondrous thing that had ever been seen, that throughout the whole year, there were in Rome, apart from the Roman people, 200,000 pilgrims, not counting those on the roads coming and going. And all of them were provided for, fed and housed in the right manner, the horses as well as the people, and with great patience and without noise or fights. And I can testify to this, who was present and saw it. And the offerings made by the pilgrims brought to the church great treasure, and all the Romans became rich.
You've been listening to episode 20 of The Vatican Centuries, written by Jill Bevilacqua and produced by Sean Patrick Lovett. You can hear the next episode, entitled The Long Absence, at this same time next week. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English programme for today. Join us again at this same time tomorrow, or find us on the internet, www.vaticanradio.org/English. For now, stay tuned to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.